Alan Kring Productions presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 4 for Spring Semester 2017. Lecture 10, delivered on February 22, 2017. The title of this lecture is Introduction to Debt.
Today, Introduction to Debt. Now, I've talked about debt before in the class, and I will be coming back to it over and over again. Debt is one of the ways that a company can finance its operations. Borrow money and then pay it back later. Debt comes in all kinds of different varieties. The one thing about debt is that it has the prior claim on the assets of a company. So in other words, the debt holders are going to get their money before shareholders, stockholders, get a penny. And if the debt holders cannot be paid, then the company will be taken into bankruptcy by the debt holders, at least theoretically. Just to start this out, first of all, debt, the market for debt, primary issue debt, is 10 times the size of the stock market. Debt is a much, much more common way to externally finance operations than is the stock market. Also, the stock market is by definition a capital market. When a company sells stock, stock lives forever. So that comes from those investors who want a long-term investment. Whether or not they actually do, or if they're just those speculators and flippers, that's irrelevant. The stock market is a market for funds that are long haul. The debt market, on the other hand, can be a short-term, intermediate-term, or long-term market, depending upon what kind of debt you're talking about. But the thing is that the debt market is 10 times the size of the stock market. However, it is not talked about nearly as much as the stock market is. And it's simply because it's not a sexy market. It's not exciting. There's nothing to get excited. You can't get on Financial News Network and do exciting streamers of information about companies and the stock price going up by 30% or down by 20% a day. No, it's a very quiet, boring, stable market. You are Tom Cruise in one of the Mission Impossible movies. Okay? Well, of course we're going to talk about you. You are Beyoncé. You are going to be someone who is quite popular. You, on the other hand, are just a typical college student at Illinois State University. No one cares, okay? Same for me. I'm a professor at Illinois State University. Really? Well, that must be a really exciting life you live, said no one ever. So, but the sexy people are going to get all the press. And that's part of it. He's Mel Gibson. Yes, he's going to get press because he snorts cocaine. You are going to be the wife of a man named Bubba at a federal facility for doing the same thing. Okay? And that's the unfortunate part of it, is the bond market is such a powerful, huge, massive market. It moves the world. The stock market really, quite honestly, doesn't. But it is the glitzy, the sexy market. It's the one where you can make the big money, not the small change. You see, because most debt instruments at their end, I mean, in the corporate and government world, at the end of their life, they pay you $1,000. If the company is still alive, or if the government is still alive. You get $1,000. Now, along the way, you might get interest payments, but at the end, you get $1,000. So, essentially, you think about every bond or debt instrument that pays $1,000 again, that $1,000 is going to be sort of like a stable point. Below it, it's going to prices, if the bond goes far below it and the bond is still okay, eventually it will come back up to $1,000. If the bond is riding at a premium to par above $1,000, it will eventually come back down on that. So that in the last days before a bond matures, this price is probably going to be about $1,000. There's essentially a limit to how far it could go in any direction. On the other hand, stock could go through the roof or it could plow into the dirt. So there's a lot more speculative advantage in that. So it's like the difference between you working a 9-to-5 job and you buying lotto tickets every week. The ups and downs of the lotto are going to be much, much bigger than that paycheck every week, even though the paycheck is a much safer investment for you to make working a normal job, and leave the lotto tickets to fools. Although I have to say I buy one every once in a while, just because, who knows. Let me show you, and I've done this before, and I'm going to just do this again. I'm going to show you, debt comes in all manner of maturities. Remember how I said that if it is less than or equal to 1 year, we call those bills. If it is between 10 years, and it depends, some will say 7, some will say 10, it's a note. And above 10 years or so, we call that a bond. Now, I get into the main meat of the bonds chapter on Monday, but here I'm giving you some of the background, the story. And within these categories, there are all kinds of things that can happen, all kinds of different flavors. Now, I'm going to focus most of the course from here on with corporate and government debt. Now, as far as, let me do one that's a very short term. Corporate debt instrument. Your company issues 28-day paper for $992.12. What is the annualized yield on that paper? Now, a couple of things here. I told you something that you don't need to know. And I didn't tell you something that you do need to know. I said the thing that you don't need to know is I said annualized. Unless someone says something differently, in business, a rate, a yield, it's an interest rate, a growth rate, a depreciation rate, whatever is annualized. That's what we're looking for, is the annualized. Okay, so it's annualized. So you really won't see me use this term annualized too often, because that's what I expect to get, is an annualized. My straight up calculation would get me a 28-day, but what I'm going to do will turn it into an annualized. Now, the other thing is the face value of this. I'm issuing this for 28 days. In other words, you're going to lend me money. You're going to lend me $992.12. 28 days later, I have to pay you back. I am going to pay you back $1,000. It's not up there, but it is. Always assume $1,000. Unless I say differently, assume $1,000. So in other words, you, the buyer of my paper, the lender to me. And here's that thing again. Buyer is the lender, otherwise known as the investor. The seller is the borrower, otherwise known as the issuer. Now I'm going to start using these terms like they're just, I'm not going to explain them, I'm just going to keep saying it and you'll get the hang of it. That when I say issuer of paper, that's the borrower. Issue of paper is the borrower. So if the issue of the paper is the, bingo, brilliant. And the investor in the paper, the buyer of the paper, is the bingo. You already got it down. You're speaking like a native, okay? So now, what we want to do here is watch this. First thing we got to do is figure out how much of a year 28 days is. Because face over price to the one over the number of years minus all minus one is the annualized yield. And I don't even have to say again, this will be the last time I say the annualized. That'll be the yield. Okay? Now I've got to figure out, though, and this is where it's actually, it's super easy, but for heaven's sake, for God's sake, watch it when you do the rounding. Don't round if you don't have to. So what I'm going to do here first is, in this case, I need to find out how much of a year, how much of a year is 28 days. And the way I do that is I simply say 28 divided by 360. And you're saying, why 360? Why not 365? It depends upon where you are, whom you ask, and all of that. Now, interestingly, one course that I teach, financial institutions, we use 360. This course seems to use 365, but it's not going to be a huge difference, but I'm just going to use the 360 here, but do know that I believe in this book they do the 365 thing. The 360 historically was used ostensibly because there are 360 bankers' days in a year. In reality, it was because there's an old trick that I won't show you here, but you could manually divide by 360 very easily. But I won't bother to show you because it takes some mathematical skill none of us have anymore. So anyway, so I've got that number. Now, the way I do it, and I do these on a scientific calculator, I'm just going to put in that in the memory plus slot, okay? And then what I'll do is I'm going to crank the calculation. Open parenthesis, 1,000, oops, divided by 992.12, close the parenthesis, and then I'm going to raise that y to the x. Open parenthesis, 1 divided by memory recall. Close the parenthesis, minus 1 equals 10.71%. So in other words, I did 1,000 over 992.12 to the 1 over 28 over 360 minus 1. And that was that 0.07 bar. and that comes up with 0.1071, 10.71%. Here's the thing that's important to know. Finance has a nice little thing. If you make a mistake, or an arithmetic mistake in finance, you're probably going to make a mistake that involves taking something to a power. So your answer is going to be so far whacked that you'll know that there's a problem. You'll know you don't have it. You'll get an interest rate like 2,000,000% or 1/1,000,000th of a percent. It'll blow up or it'll go crazy. You see me. I make arithmetic mistakes. I mean, I taught math for years. I screwed up so many generations of kids. It's pathetic. I mean, I mess them up almost as much as my own kids. God, they're all a mess. Anyway, getting back to this, 10.71% looks right. That's a reasonable rate, annualized yield on commercial paper. Notice that that's actually a fairly high rate. Now, this kind of money, remember I told you that funds that come for less than a year come from the money market. Funds more than a year come from the capital market. So in other words, if you are a company issues $1 million in bonds, you know right away that whether it's 10, 20, or 30 years, those are you are in the capital market. You're an investor in the capital market. Now, if you are actually the guy who's buying commercial paper, you would be a money market player. Now, you can survive. What you would probably do is you'd have maybe $20 million, and if you're a player in that market, which some fairly wealthy people are, all the time you're simply snatching up paper for 28 days, 30 days, and then when that pays off, you're just buying more paper. So you're continuously running these yields of between 9 and 13%. At all times, that's your life. That's what you do. Okay? And so you can be a money market player. The textbook I use, which is actually a pretty good textbook in 241, says the money market is like just this temporary warehouse for funds. Actually, no. I know plenty of people who investors who do all of their play in the money market. And because, I mean, those yields aren't bad. Those yields don't suck. And it's relatively quick turnover of money, so if you ever did need your money for something else, it comes back to you relatively quickly. Now, there are all kinds of money market types of securities where you could be the lender or the borrower. Now, one where, I don't know, some of you have probably actually played, I know almost every one of you has been an investor in at least one money market. But I'll bring that one up second. One where a number of people are investors in the money market is one-year CDs. Have any of you ever bought a one-year CD or something like that? They're terrible, their rates are right now. I mean, they're just wretched. About 6 months ago, I looked at the rate on a one-year CD. It was 0.1%. 0.1%. Interestingly enough, now the rate has gone up to 0.8%. Which still sucks, but that's an awfully big jump in it, okay? So anyway, okay, here's one where you actually, almost every one of you, I'm sure, are actually investors in a money market. Do you have a checking account? Okay. I'm a bank, you put your money with me, you are actually a lender to me. On the bank's financial statements, you put in, let's say, $5,000, like you have five. Okay, you're kind of rolling around. Yeah, right. Okay, $5,000. I mean, that is a liability. I am borrowing that money from you. So on my bank books, it shows up as a liability of a $5,000 owed to you, short-term, money market. And on the other side, on the asset side, it shows up as $5,000 in cash in my bank. So clearly you are all players in at least, oh, well, not maybe some of you aren't, but most of you are players in that market. Now, there are all kinds of other, I mean, there's just a garden variety. There are these things called repurchase agreements, bankers' acceptances, letters of credit. All of these are less than a year. This one right here, if this is a large creditworthy borrower, that paper is called commercial paper. It has a very, it's a huge market. It's a dense market. Banks that lend money to companies for their floor planning at the beginning of every year, technically that's a money market. That is a money market because the bank expects to be paid off within the year. In the case of my company, I am borrowing heavily. I've been borrowing heavily for the first 2 months of this year, and I'll keep borrowing heavily into early April. As I build inventory and the shows are starting to show up, start next month, I will then be able to make money and start to pay off that. By the end of maybe November, I will be flat with the bank again. So the bank has expanded my credit and lent me money for less than a year, and I pay it back to them as I can as the year proceeds, and hopefully I have a good selling season this year. And if any of you are around, there is an art show at the Bone Student Center on, it's the Spring Bloom Arts Festival on March the 18th. No, I can't sell you anything. Don't even try. But you can walk in there and make fun of my art and criticize me heavily. But anyway, now, I wanted to show you something. Let me show you something. I'm showing this to you for two reasons. One is because it's an interesting market in and of itself, and it's a huge market. It is a money market. But then also there is this weird dark side, a sort of like a twisted cousin of what I'm about to show you. Now, many years ago, what I'm about to show you would have been available only to very large companies and individuals. You, madam, are Walmart. Now, well, actually, you're a Walmart, except that you're not open 24 hours a day. You're open from 8 in the morning till 5 in the afternoon. And you need your money available from your retail operation during that time. And then at the end of the day, you put all your money in the bank. And then when the next day starts, you pull your money out of the bank so that you can have transactions, money for customers, and also so that you can be paying bills through the day with your accountants, bookkeepers, and all that, okay? But during that time, from 5 o'clock at night until 8 o'clock the next morning, your money is just sitting there, flat on its back. Technically, a checking account can't pay interest. That used to be illegal, and it still is not very common. Here's what I can do for you as a banker. And I found out, I thought for years, I had always known this was for big, big players. It was about 30 years ago I ran into the first small company that was doing the same thing. And I found out that it's been expanding ever since then. The first company I saw that was doing it that was small was an insurance agency. During the day, people would come in and pay their insurance premiums, give cash and checks to the agency. And then at the end of every day, the owner of the agency would take the money to the bank and put it in. And then he told me what he was doing. He said, "This is so cool." And I thought, this is something that's been around for a long time. You're way too small to be doing it. And it was only later that I found out others were doing it too, and it wasn't, as long as a bank has a lot of players, here's how it works. The sun goes around the world, well, you know, it looks like it is. And as the sun goes down, here in central time zone, your money goes into the bank. What the bank is going to do is it's going to take your money and all of the other money that's just been deposited, and it's going to sweep it out of your accounts. Okay? At, let's say, 5 p.m. Central Standard Time, CST. Okay? Your money and all this other money in the bank is all going to be swept out into a giant international money market pool. It's all going to flow in there, and then at 5 p.m. Mountain Standard Time, more money will be flowing in. And then Pacific Standard Time, 5 o'clock p.m., more money will be flowing in. And then over the course of the money that had already come in from the Eastern Standard Time at 5 o'clock when the sun was going down there. All this money flowing in, and as the sun goes around the world, money is just flowing in from all these different parts of the world. And then, as the sun rises on some part of the world, their money is coming back out into their bank accounts so that it's available to them for their next day's transactions, uses. And at any given time, there's this giant bladder of money, international money market funds available to currency traders, short-term borrowers of money, players of all kind, on the scale of probably about $1 trillion. At any given time, there's a giant wad of money in the system. Money that is flowing in, money that's flowing out, and then the money that's spinning around in there for its 12 to 15 hour cycle, there it is. That is what maintains the liquidity of the international monetary system. That right there. It's a money market. So when you see a book that kind of poo-poos the money market, well, that's just like a warehouse until people figure out what they're really going to do. Oh, God, no. I mean, that's the liquidity. That is the oil chamber that runs the car. Is that $1 trillion or whatever it is that right these days moving that market? Now the dark side. When you go to a gas, there are gas stations that do this. It's a famous, nasty trick that they do. You go to a gas station, oh, we accept your credit card or your debit card right here at the pump. You don't have to walk in the store. Aren't we wonderful sons of bitches? No, you know what they're doing? They know that you probably won't pull more than $50 worth of gas. They're going to lock $100. As soon as you stick your card in, they will lock 100, and then they will debit the amount that you use, and then they'll keep, let's say you spend $40. They keep $60 for about 5 days, and then they put it back into your account. But for 5 days, they are playing with that money. You watch what happens. They will take it out of your account, and then they'll get it back to you before you notice it or before you can complain and threaten a lawsuit or something. And they've been doing this for years. So you think about a relatively modest chain of gas stations, 5,000 customers a day use their debit cards, $60 is locked in that doesn't belong to this company from each of those 5,000 credit card users. $60 times 5,000 is, spank me, $300,000. And on a cycle of 5 days that they keep that money before they sweep it back into your account by refunding it and say, we didn't need that money, you take that $300,000 times 5 days, $1.5 million at any given time, they are making the money market rate on that money, not you. And so you say, did that really happen? Yeah, as a matter of fact, if any of you notice, there's these places you can rent a movie for a dollar, these boxes, all you have to do is give them your credit card, and you spend only a dollar to get a movie or $2 to get a movie. See any of those? They're doing the same thing to you. Every time you take out a movie, they say, oh, well, we'll have to take out the whole cost of that movie, even though there's a very low probability that they actually would have to debit it. They'll take out $30, $40, lock it, but they won't give it back to you for days. They won't put it back in your account, so during that time, they are earning interest. That's where they make their money. They are a financial investor. They just happen to use your money against your, without your knowledge by providing you with a service. But their big money they make is off the play that they make with the money that they lock from your account for those 5 days or 4 days or whatever they do. And is it illegal? No, it's not. Okay? So, that ought to make you feel good. By the way, the legitimate version of this, what you do by consent if you've got a bank or retail, this is called a sweep. These sweeps are now, small companies can do sweeps. As a matter of fact, interestingly enough, my bank told me that I don't owe anything for borrowing for the season's inventory. When I finish a show and put my money, take it to the bank and put it into my account, the checks and all that that have been paid for my artwork, they can actually set up a sweep now for this, that kind of money too. So it doesn't have to be every day. It can be like, I can put a bunch of money in there and they can say, well, we can sweep it for 28 days, we can sweep it for 35 days, whatever it is you want, 60 days. So it's not gonna happen for another year or two yet until I'm more stable, but there you go. Okay, now. Government and corporate. Most of what we talk about when we talk about debt is government and corporate. Now, what I'm talking about here for the next few lectures, we're talking about the primary market. In other words, some company is borrowing money, or the government is borrowing money, and some investor is lending money to the government or to a corporation. That's the primary market. The secondary market is where players just buy back and forth stocks and bonds, which isn't what we're talking about here. Now, the government has all kinds, all manner of different debt securities. They got the usual kind, the one-year T-bills, and then they got the T-notes of various kinds, like the 7-year T-notes, and then they've got the T-bonds, treasury bonds. That's one way, by maturity. Now, the typical auction of the treasury will put on the table, the virtual table these days, a variety of different instruments, some T-bills, some T-notes, some T-bonds, to raise the money they need. In other words, the government cannot live within the money that it has. It has to borrow money in order for it to pay its bills. Unlike a corporation, the government will pay its bills. It will simply, if it has bonds that it has to pay off, it'll just borrow the money to pay those off with new bonds. Corporations sometimes can do that, but it's not really a good idea for a corporation to live that way for too many years. Now, the government, the reason the government borrows money is because we don't have enough tax revenue and we have too many expensive programs. The most expensive, our tax rates have been very low for a number of years, for quite a few years. Back a long, long time ago, they were higher. We paid our bills. We had very strong growth rates, but that's not how it works anymore. So we don't raise the money through taxes to pay our bills, but then we have lavish programs of all kinds. Everything from social welfare programs, which are actually quite minimal, on through to complete, absolutely awesome theater wars. And we have to pay for those and for all the things in between. Now, who are the lenders to the government, U.S. government? The government debt outstanding of about $16 trillion, three-fourths of that is held by two distinct entities. When the government needs to borrow money, one of the two heavies that come to the auctions to lend the government money, in other words, to buy treasury paper, one of those two is the government's own central bank. The central bank will simply print a bunch of money, go to the auction, and buy treasury bills, in other words, lend you the government money, and then it'll take those treasury bills back, and it will hold them. It might play money supply games with banks with them, but eventually, you, the government, will have to pay those off to the Federal Reserve. So how will you, the government, pay those off to the Federal Reserve? You'll just borrow more money. And then what I'll do as the Fed is I'll print money to go to that auction so that you can have money to spend for new programs and also have the money to pay me back what I lent you on the last auction. Now, if there's something in there that you say, now, wait a minute, that just ain't right. Good for you. Go bitch to someone about it. Okay, now, that's one of the two big players in the treasury market, in the government market. The other giant player that's always there at the auctions, or almost always there, are foreign central banks. When you buy stuff from any foreign country, your dollars go to the central bank of that country, and then the central bank gives the merchant the local currency. But then the central bank has American dollars, and the only place that a central an American dollar can be spent is back in this country that minted it, in this case, the United States. So in other words, when the government borrows money, it is borrowing money that you paid some other country to buy something from that country. Now, the big countries that come to our auctions that have tons and tons of our money, the big 800-pound gorilla is China. Let us try not to piss off China, because if they don't lend us the money, then it's going to be a catastrophe. But we also have others. Many other countries have a surplus of American dollars. They bring them back here to spend them by lending us money. What is the country that sells us the most oil? What is it? Canada. It's Canada. People say Saudi Arabia. No, Canada. And so let's not piss off the Canadians, eh? Okay. South America, a lot of oil from that dirty communist regime down there in Venezuela. A lot of those darned countries over in the Middle East, they sell us oil. Interestingly enough, we didn't put a ban on Muslims coming into the country from the ones that sell us the most oil. Funny about that, even though the biggest of them, Saudi Arabia, was the country of origin of 7 of the 9 terrorists of 9/11. But business is business, you know, and all that. Other countries that provide funds to us at our auctions, who else? Japan, big heavy. We buy cars. I've got a Japanese car. It's a great car. But of course, you say, well, you should buy American. Well, that would be rather difficult unless I have this guy I know named Earl put together a car for me in his shop. Otherwise, the parts come from all over the world. Other players, Europe, I mean, they lend us money all the time because we buy stuff more from Europe than they buy from us. So they've got a surplus of American dollars they lend back to us. That's where our government gets most of its money. Now, other places the government gets its money, you can see this in the book too. Pension funds are a big place. Insurance companies like to lend money to us because that way it's safe and it's there for a long time. You, sir, are going to die, but probably not tomorrow. So, in other words, a life insurance company isn't going to want to invest in something that pays off tomorrow. It's going to want to invest in something that will pay off many, many years in the future. And it's safe because we know you're going to die. So we need the certainty that it's going to pay off. The government provides that kind of certainty. But we know that you're not going to die, or at least it's very unlikely you'll die tomorrow, unless that party tonight gets out of hand. Okay, so the bottom line is that insurance companies are big players, life and health. Other ones, like I said, pension funds. You put money into a pension fund. You're not going to be wanting that money for 40 years. So that would be probably pension funds would like to invest in this kind of money. This is true also of corporate debt, too. I don't want to restrict it to the government. Corporate debt can be riskier. It is riskier. No corporation is perfectly safe. If you want safety, you go to the government. But remember, with safety comes lower interest rates. I do want to point out one thing, though, about government debt. Our current debt outstanding is about $16 trillion. A couple of times, we started bringing in more than we were paying out. At the end of the Eisenhower administration, we did that for a year. We came close to it at the end of the Carter administration. But then, in the last years, 4 years running, in the Clinton administration, we were actually bringing in more than we were paying out, so we were paying off the national debt. Well, that went all to hell. And so now we are way in the hole, about $16 trillion total debt, and every year we're borrowing another trillion or so, something like that. However, that does not include all government debt. What I've been describing is the on-balance government debt. Government agencies, many of them issue their own debt, not under the full faith and credit of the U.S. government, but everyone assumes that it's about as safe as government debt. This is called agency debt. So a good example would be the Tennessee Valley Authority. It issues its own bonds for its projects. And that is agency debt that's not in the government's main debt. They borrow theirs in their own auctions at their own with their own sets of lenders. And none of this includes all of this local and state government that also borrows money. All of this money that goes into building roads and fixing bridges and funding schools and all of that kind of stuff, all is part of local and state government that is in excess of the $16 trillion that I told you about the federal government borrows. And there has to be a very big market to lend that kind of money out. Thank God we have all of these investors who are still willing to lend us money. Why? Because they have such high faith and have had for many, many years in the U.S. government and its ability to pay its bills and have high-quality debt instruments. There are all manner of, like I said, I mean, you've got some of this government debt is even indexed to inflation. They're called TIPS, Treasury Indexed Price Securities or something like that. Treasury Inflation Priced Securities, TIPS. You've got other kinds of government debt, agency debt, the different time periods of debt. Now, interestingly enough, just to give you an idea of how varied the bond market can be and the debt market, I got a story about this. One of the weirder stories that I ever had in my consulting work. But anyway, World War II was hellaciously hard on Europe. I mean, the place was just bombed back literally to the Stone Age in places. Rubble, entire cities across Europe were in rubble. So it was just an absolute disaster zone from one end to the other. Now, we could have just said, that's your problem, Europe. Tough luck. Hope you can rebuild it. But we knew very well there were two reasons why we would want to help them. One was because of our historical ties to Europe. Many of our people came from European ancestry. But a much more practical reason is that on the other side of Europe was the Soviet Union, which had helped us win World War II, but they were not our friends. They were communists. They helped us kick the asses of the Nazis, but then they were going about the business of consolidating communist control of Eastern Europe. And if we had not helped Western Europe, the Russians would have been there to offer their assistance. In Soviet Russia, we do not rebuild. We make you live in rubble, comrade. So we initiated a plan after World War II called the Marshall Plan. We were going to rebuild Europe from the rubble up. And in order to do that, it was going to cost a hellacious amount of money, and we were going to borrow the money. The U.S. government was going to borrow the money to rebuild Europe. So the government figured, okay, we are going to have to issue a special kind of bond. The U.S. government, Treasury, was going to have to issue a special kind of bond because a lot of investors were figuring there's going to be an inflation coming along, so we don't want to issue the kind of debt that investors would be shy of because inflation's going to come. We had printed scads of money during World War II because we had to basically build an army from the ground up, a navy, an air force, and it cost a huge amount of money, an insanely large amount of money. And quite honestly, the first two, three years of the war, we were getting our asses kicked in the Pacific Theater. It took us a while and a lot of money just to learn how to have an effective military force again after World War I, which kind of sucked anyway. Okay, so here's what our government did. Okay, we are going to offer investors, lenders to us, a special bond that will pay off not in U.S. dollars, which could erode if there's an inflation. We will offer a bond that pays off in gold from Fort Knox. Gold bonds. They'll pay off in gold. In other words, they'll be inflation, completely inflation resistant. Oh, investors just went crazy over these. Oh, yeah, these are the thing. They were just snatched up. It was a very successful issue, several issues. And the Marshall Plan came through, and Europe was rebuilt, and Europe was our ally from Italy to Spain to France to Germany to into the North countries. I mean, everyone loved us. But there was a problem with that whole deal, though, because you know who actually was buying those gold bonds? Who were the lenders to the government? And when it came due, they got gold from us. It was the old, extremely wealthy families of Europe who were buying the gold bonds. And so when the bonds came due, we nearly eviscerated Fort Knox, giving our gold to the European rich, the nobility, the ancients of that land. We've never recovered the full impact of what was done to Fort Knox by those investors from Europe. And then we rebuilt those sons of bitches, we rebuilt their country, and then they took our gold from us. Well, it was a deal. It worked out. Okay, here's my story. It was in the mid-1990s, and I think it was 1996. I got all kinds of weird things come across my desk. I don't know why, but I was a lightning rod for the stupidest, strangest stuff you could ever imagine. And I got a call from a guy in New York. His name was Paul, and he was a very shadowy, shady player, but he was also, his deals almost always had some smell of legitimacy. And he called me and said, "Alan, I've got a couple of people I want you to meet. They're very old, and they've got something they want to show you. They've shown it to everyone else. No one else knows what to do with it, but I figured we'd give it a shot with you. I have paid for them to fly into your city. I'm putting them up at a motel. They're going to be in your office 9 o'clock tomorrow morning. Will you be there?" Well, hell, I mean, if you're going to have these people come here, yeah. So, "Alan, just listen to them. Just listen to them." Okay. So they came. It was 9 o'clock, and right on the dot, these two elderly people came to the door, and they were carrying a big wooden box. The lady was. They were walking very slowly, and I introduced myself, and they introduced themselves. They had a very slight. They were Swiss. Apparently, Swiss was their background, but they had a slight German accent. And we talked for a while about what their lives had been like. They had been survivors of World War II, Jewish, and they had lost some people in the Holocaust. But they talked with me for a while. I served them tea. Very nice people. Old, very dignified. And I said, "Okay, let's see what's in the box. Paul didn't tell me, and you haven't mentioned it yet. Let's see." Lady opens the box, and she pulls out, and she's shaking like that, and she shows them to me. 10 $100 million World War II gold bonds. They were I knew enough they looked authentic. I almost dropped my jaw. "Are you kidding?" And they said, "No one will honor them. We need to find someone who will make your government honor these." I don't know what to do. I immediately called a friend of mine in New York City. It wasn't Paul. It was someone who knew Paul. And I said, I got two people in my office. They've got 10 gold bonds. Oh, he said, and he named, "Oh, you're part of those people. You know them?" "Yeah, everyone knows them." "Well, why haven't you helped them?" "Because no one can help them." "You're sure?" "Yeah." "Well, how much are these worth now?" He said, "Well, at the current price of gold, those are probably what she's got, that lady's got in the box." "Does she have 10? "Yes. Probably about $6 billion. "What?" No one would help them. They said they just cannot be honored. These people had spent their whole lives. Apparently, they just kept them for years after they were supposed to be redeemed. And they just... son of a dog. I mean, there wasn't anything I could do for him. They left. They were very, they were crestfallen. Supposedly, I was the last hope of all. You know, some loser in a small office in a cruddy neighborhood in Ohio. What can you do? I talked to the guy about him 6 months later. That was our big topic of conversation. I said, isn't there anything? He said, no. He said, no one. He said, yes, they're authentic. Yes, of course they are. But who's going to honor them this many years after World War II? They're not, he said someone offered them like $250,000 as historical documents to put in an archive. And they said, no, these are worth $6 million. And they should have taken the money. I mean, seriously. If I had known that they'd been offered $250,000, I would have said, take it. You're old. You're going to die. This is at least something you can have a last good meal. Anyway, okay. So, corporate bonds. First things first, just very quickly on this piece, and then we're going to do that online test. NFLX 5.2%, 2047. Now, what I would be describing here, this is most likely a primary issue. Okay? In other words, this is not something that's already out there in the secondary market. And I know that because of this year right here. This will pay off in 30 years. That would be a very normal thing for a new bond. Now, if this were 2023, I'd say, oh, that's only only 6 years away. So that's probably a bond that's been spinning out there for some time. It's a secondary market. But when it's 30 years out there, I would say that's either a new issue or close to a new issue from Netflix itself. The 5.2%, that is the coupon rate. It is always expressed as a percent of face value. So I know right off the bat that every year for the next 30 years, this bond is going to pay its holder $52. I know that. I also know that in 2047, the holder is going to get one last check for $52, and then that holder is going to get $1,000 from Netflix to retire the account. Okay? To retire the bond. It will be over in 2047. Now, the original holder probably won't be. I mean, you might be someone who would buy original issue. But 10 years from now, you might sell it to me. So I would get the last 20 years of the coupons and the face value after you sold it to me. Okay? So, I mean, it's not like you buy a bond and then you're stuck with it forever. You can get rid of it. Now, this coupon is going to be based at least to a large extent. Well, it's going to be based on the economic circumstances of the time in which it's issued. But it will also be based upon the rating of the bond. There are three bond rating services that are big: Standard & Poor's, Moody's, and Fitch. Now, they have slightly different systems. They all have A's and B's, AAA, BAA. Some of them have capital letters and lowercase letters. Some of them all capital letters. Some of them have pluses and minuses. But know this. A and B starting will be what we call investment grade. In other words, they are safe bonds. Now, the higher the rating, the lower the coupon in general. The lower the rating, the higher the coupon. Anything that is a C or a D, we have these euphemisms for it. We will say that it is a high yield bond. Well, that's because the coupon is going to be ridiculously high compared to a safe one. Another one we might say is it is a speculative grade bond. Speculative grade. Now, I want you to say it's a junk bond. Say that.
It's junk.
No, don't say that, okay? That hurts their little feelings. They have feelings too. Bonds have these little feeling nerves all through them. You call them junk. I mean, how are they going to grow up? I'm junk. God don't love me. I'm junk. No, don't say junk. That hurts them. Because we don't know what could happen. Someday they'll grow up. Maybe they could even be stock someday. There's actually a way that bonds can become stock. Did you know that? If it's a convertible bond. See, if I am a smart and I know my bonds, I can't pay you. You've lent me money. I can make a provision in the bond. It's called a conversion provision. So that if I can't pay you the interest payment, before you can take me to a court and close my company down, I could turn your bond into stock, and then you're a stockholder. You know what you can do as a stockholder to me when I don't pay you a dividend? Nothing. Diddly squat. You can't do anything to me. So I can convert. So you got to watch it. Bonds can play tricks on you. Now, one last thing about this bond. This system here. You got to be careful because investment, speculative grade doesn't mean you're going to lose on it. You could lose, but sometimes it's worth a try. For example, JCPenney and Sears. JCPenney, its bonds are not doing well. They're being rated low, but there's a lot of belief that they'll pull through. Sears, on the other hand, Sears did something 2 weeks ago that probably was, for someone like me, was the signal that was the death rattle. Does anyone know what Sears did 2 weeks ago? They sold their Craftsman brand name to Black & Decker. Essentially, that's you're selling. It's sort of like if you rent your services to Walmart. I know you're having problems, but you'll come through them. But let's say you sell your body to Madame Tussauds House of Young Men. It's over. She'll give you three hots and a cot because you're three times hot, and all you need is a cot. But I can make your face red once in a while anyway. But you understand it's a bad sign. So speculative grade doesn't mean it's dead. But watch it. Look at the other things. Don't just look at the rating. Look at other things too.